Shall I start you? Okay, great. thank you everybody for joining us today for this special meeting session of the Faculty Senate. My name is Nima Kudva and I'm the Associate Dean of Faculty and Professor in the Department of City and Regional Planning. I am going to read out our land acknowledgement first. So Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gaiahono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gaiahono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gaiahono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gaiahono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. I am going to actually just work our way through some of the rules for the Senate meetings. We welcome many new senators as we move into a new year. And so so our new Dean of Faculty, Eve DeRosa, and I thought it may be a good idea for us to just go through some of these rules. So the first, of course, when we are on Zoom, do stay muted unless you are called upon to speak. And if you want to speak, you know, we ask that you raise your Zoom hand, which will put you into an automatic queue, and that you request permission to speak using the Zoom hand. When the speaker of the session, who we will introduce shortly, you know, sort of mentions your name, you can unmute yourself and speak up. When you are unmuted and speaking, we ask that you keep yourself to 2 minutes to either pose a question or to make your statement. In terms of chat, the policies have changed just a little bit. All chats will be going to the administrators of the meetings and then we will read them out. And so please do submit your comments, your questions, and then we will post that back out as we can. The recorded session will start at 3:30, so please note that you are being recorded. And then the audio and the chat of the meeting will be posted on the DOF's agenda webpage soon after the meeting when we are able to clean things up. And we don't vote when we are in Zoom session, we don't vote in immediately on resolutions. We do that after the meeting. So please do watch out for your email, and the vote happens by Qualtrics, using Qualtrics. So we are not going to be having a closed captioning person this academic year. What we are going to be having is Zoom captioning. And so go into the more thing. Jill tells me, no, I'm saying something wrong there. Oh, so she was just wondering about live transcription. So what's going to happen right now is that all our captioning is happening automatically. So if you go into the more button on the top right-hand corner of your screen, you can enable closed captioning if you need that. A couple of other things that I just want to add in terms of the voting. I just want to remind all senators that votes are limited to one vote or one or two, depending on, you know, how your department works. And so if the alternate is voting, you may not vote. Only one person can vote, right? Not both. The other piece is that as senators, we of course vote our conscience, but we are asking you, to go back, to carry the deliberations of this body back into your departments, to share that with colleagues, and to bring their concerns and issues raised back into the Faculty Senate. So we become a truly representative body, which can, you know, speak for the diverse interests and voices of our faculty and our RTE colleagues. So the last thing I want to raise is that if you are not a Cornell faculty member or on the RTE at Cornell, you do need to let the administrators of this meeting, which is Dean of Faculty Eve DeRosa, myself, and Jill Short of the Dean of Faculty office, as well as the speaker, you need to let us know that. And if you are a member of the press, please identify yourself. If there is a member of the press present here, you need to identify yourself so the Senate knows that you are joining us for this meeting. So that said, welcome again, and I'm going to turn this over to the Dean of Faculty, Eve DeRosa.
Welcome everyone to this special Senate on the fall reopening. And I want to open today's meeting with a vote for our candidate for speaker. This is a very important role. And so first I would like to thank Professor Jonathan Oxhorn for being willing to serve in this role. It's a critical role for the Senate, for the health of the Senate, and for us to be able to have a really healthy discourse. So I'm very appreciative. Our intention was to share his CV earlier as we were planning for the September 22nd scheduled Senate meeting. And so our apologies that it had to be relatively short notice, but hopefully you've had a chance to review his CV. But I'm going to give a brief introduction so that you can have a sense of what a wonderful scholar he is. So Professor Oxhorn is a professor in the Department of Architecture, and he has deep Cornell roots. He was an undergraduate here at Cornell. He has grown up here as an assistant professor to full professor in the Department of Architecture. And he has many honorifics. He's been a Fulbright scholar. He's had a faculty fellows and service grant where undergraduates in architecture have the opportunity to be involved in preliminary design of for local nonprofits. And so he's very the Cornell ethos. He has a scholarship, but then he takes it out into the world, into practice. And as evidence of that, he's been a registered architect since he graduated from Cornell many years ago. But I would say my favorite tidbit as somebody who is a dancer is that he served as a piano accompanist for dance. I was very jealous that he was an accompanist for a master class with Alvin Ailey. So I just wanted to share that with you before we vote. And we were going to present a poll to you. We ask that only faculty senators vote, and we'll share the results with you immediately after. And we're going to limit the vote to 2 minutes. And so, Jill, if you could share that poll, that would be great. I see a hand up. Laurent? I forgot he has an injured wrist. Yeah,
I don't have the hand up. It's just me showing up my orange cast, so that's fine.
Actually, I think we could probably move forward. We have a quorum, so we can move forward. Congratulations, Speaker Oxhorn. And I guess we will have our call to order.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back in the Senate in this capacity. And I think my first order of business is to recognize the Dean of Faculty, Eve DeRosa, for 10 minutes. So you're back on.
Thank you. I'm learning the rules as we go along, so I'm very appreciative to have a speaker really overseeing this. So thank you. I wanted to first introduce President Pollack. I've yielded a few minutes of my time so that she can speak to the Senate, and then I will do my introduction. So President Pollack, if you'd like to speak.
Thank you, Eve. Thank you for giving me a little bit of time on the agenda. I want to spend that time to clarify a few points that are directly relevant to the resolutions you're going to be considering. And I want to start by being clear about what our goals are this semester. They're to provide our students with the best possible educational experience we can, consistent with protecting the health of our community. We're a residential university, and when the public health situation permits it, we are committed to providing our students with a residential experience. Now, as was true last year, we've relied on faculty experts for rigorous scientific analysis and modeling that we're continually having updated. They're informing us on risk analysis and risk mitigation. We've involved a group of stakeholders from across the campus and the team that's responsible for making and implementing plans. We've had a number of town halls to update the community and answer questions. And we've included deans and associate deans as active participants in our planning and the decisions taken. So let me first address questions about requests for medical and disability accommodations, because unfortunately there's been some confusion about the university's policies on this issue. Let me say this strongly. As always, we remain fully committed to providing medical and disability related accommodations. There have been no changes in the process of seeking or receiving such accommodations. It's important to understand that by definition, medical and disability accommodations are ways of enabling people to fulfill the essential functions of their job. And as a residential university, a large number of our faculty and staff have essential functions that require being present on campus. So for faculty, again, when the public health situation allows it, that generally includes teaching in person. Our medical leave administration staff can provide accommodations that make that essential function safer and easier to perform. And when appropriate, they can also provide leaves at full pay. But beyond that, we have also encouraged all of our units, colleges, and schools to be creative in providing arrangements for faculty and staff outside of the medical and disability accommodation process. And these arrangements can include online teaching when that's appropriate to achieve the desired educational outcomes for our students. We have to make these decisions balancing the needs of all the stakeholders. Look, it would be really difficult for faculty if you were required to provide hybrid or online teaching whenever a student requested it. And it would be difficult for students if individual faculty were given full discretion to decide when to teach online. In addition, as a community that values the contributions of all our employees, we are committed to ensuring fair treatment for non-instructional faculty and staff whose essential functions require them to be in person. Okay, let me now turn quickly to the second resolution. And we've said this multiple times, but I will repeat it. We have been and we must follow the science. We can't pick and choose. We can't say that science tells us that mask wearing is important and that students should be vaccinated and then turn on the ground and ignore what the science tells us about risk of transmission in the classroom. We can't roll our eyes at those people who ignore the science and then do the same thing ourselves. All of the evidence we have to date is that the policies in place, upgraded ventilation, mandatory masking, a very high vaccination rate, all of those result in a very low risk of acquiring COVID-19 in the classroom. We saw no evidence of transmission in the classroom all last year. We similarly have seen no evidence to date, despite a relatively high number of cases in our students. And that's also been true for a number of other universities that conduct extensive testing. We have these very high vaccination rates. You've seen them, 99% of our campus community, including 95% of our campus community, including 99% of our students and faculty. Despite that, we did start the semester with a fairly high number of positive cases among our students, about 300 students over a couple of weeks. We found these cases because we're doing aggressive testing. We regularly test all the undergraduates. We test all the formally defined contacts of anyone found positive. And then we test anyone who might be a contact, maybe because they live on the same hallway or they're in the same sorority or on the same team. And by identifying and isolating all those cases, as many as possible, we aim to break the chain of transmission. You'll recall that last fall, we also had an early spike in cases. We responded aggressively in the same sorts of ways. And it worked last year, and so far it appears to be working. Cases are coming down. But we're going to remain vigilant, and we're going to continue to track and monitor. And that extensive tracking and monitoring and testing also lets us understand where the transmission is happening. And I want to reiterate, to date, as was the case last year, there's no evidence of transmission in the classroom or instructed on campus activities. The transmission is happening in informal social events. Now look, the risk is not zero. We don't live in a zero risk world, but the layered protections, high vaccination rates, mandatory masking, enhanced ventilation, and this very aggressive testing, isolation, and tracing habit together lead to a situation where the risk is minimized. If you want to see an external perspective, I invite you to look at a column, David Lanhart's column in yesterday's New York Times. As long as it's safe to teach in the classroom, we need faculty to do just that, just as we need all of our staff with student-facing jobs to be available to our students. We need the staff who support faculty to be available for to the faculty, in all cases with approved accommodations or arrangements for those whose risk is higher. I just want to close by saying that Mike and I deeply appreciate all you're doing to support our students and to honor our commitment to them during what we know are these very, very challenging times. I'm going to apologize in advance. I was supposed to be on another meeting starting at 3:30, which I'm going to now hop off and go to. It's a meeting with community leaders. But I appreciate your time, and Eve, thank you for ceding some of your time to me.
Thank you, President Pollack, and thank you, Provost Kotlikoff. So we are now going to ask the President and the Provost to log off. I just wanted to yield some time to them so they can present their point of view, but most importantly, we're here in our session now, so it's just faculty, and I call this special Senate meeting because of hearing the voices of our faculty and the concerns. So this is why I had the listening session and the special Senate meeting. We obviously were planning for the 22nd, but I think this was really critical for us to be here today. And I wanna thank the faculty for being here and the faculty senators for being here. I know you're here because you care about governance and you care about the Senate. And so faculty governance is why we're having the Senate meeting today. And I guess the most important thing is that we have these two resolutions. We're gonna be hearing from the ILR Senator Leibowitz and the government Senator Bensel. And we'll have a brief discussion after each of them. And then I really do want a full voice from the Senate and really use our general discussion in a robust way. So I hope people feel comfortable here. This is a closed session, it's just us. And with that, I yield my time to, I guess, back to Speaker Foxhorn.
Thank you, and I'll turn it over and recognize Risa Leibowitz, who will present the first resolution, 5 minutes, sorry.
Okay, I wasn't going to object to 10 minutes, but you corrected yourself, thank you. Thanks very much, Jonathan, I appreciate it, and thank you, Eve. Just an update for you on the resolution that I'm presenting, which is the resolution regarding university policies for reasonable accommodations for faculty, instructors, staff, and students during the pandemic. Update on faculty co-sponsors. We now have 82 faculty co-sponsors on this resolution, which includes 13 faculty senators. And just to give you the full update on the resolution, you'll hear from Richard Bensel on instructor discretion. We now have 75 faculty co-sponsors signing that, and that includes 12 faculty senators. So first I wanna start with some basics. And that is, we would like, of course, we would all like to be back in the classroom teaching. But obviously this is not a normal time and classrooms are not normal places. And university policy should meet the realities of the moment we're living in and the uncertainties of the moments that we're living in. Of course, it's very good to see numbers of positive tests going down over the last couple of days on the Cornell COVID dashboard. We also recognize that with unpredictable moments that the times we live in, that those numbers can go up again as they are currently in Tompkins County going up. And so what this resolution that I'm going to address calls for are university policies that will be fair and flexible enough to weather the current and future times of uncertainty in this pandemic. And to do that, this resolution calls for policymaking at Cornell that follows basic principles of safety, transparency, and consultation. These principles are fair and they are logical. To fulfill these principles, this resolution calls for actions that will eliminate flawed university policies that are in place, that will substitute for those, substitute university policies that are clear and transparent and that meet the health and safety needs of all faculty, instructors, staff, and students. And these policies that should be adopted through consultation with the Faculty Senate and other governance bodies. So if we could go to slide two. Slide two states whereases, there are also whereases on slide three, I believe. But what I'm going to do is to talk about, if you go back to slide two, yeah, thank you. I'm going to talk about the whereases clause and then move to the resolve clauses overview. So the whereases clauses in this resolution describe the flaws in the policies that the Cornell administration adopted last month in August, even as the Delta variant was spreading. Now, first of all, Cornell should be aiming for an ethical response to all faculty, instructor, staff, and student health needs. However, Cornell's August 11th and 13th policies do not meet ethical standards. And further, they don't even meet minimum legal standards under the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act and the New York State Human Rights Law. And I want to talk about that a little bit more. So the August 11th university policy states an a priori policy of refusing to approve faculty or instructor requests to teach remotely, including requests based on individuals' disability. Now, Cornell has never rescinded this August 11th policy, and President Pollack did not do that today. And in fact, on Cornell's academic resource page, it states still, full-time remote teaching is not an allowable substitute for in-person instruction. So we need to rescind that. And of course, that's in one of the resolution resolve clauses. Now, Cornell added a new policy on August 13th regarding dean's discretion, but it never rescinded the August 11th policy. Now, moving to the August 13th policy, this also fails to meet either ethical obligations or legal obligations under disabilities law. The policy gives deans some discretion to provide health-related accommodations, but then limits that discretion in a number of ways. It limits it to the deans to grant temporary, short-term, or partial accommodations, and therefore it excludes full semester remote teaching as an accommodation, even though the EEOC and CDC have both identified remote working as being reasonable during the pandemic. The policy states that accommodations, this is the August 13th policy, accommodations should be given in extraordinary circumstances. But this doesn't meet ethical and legal standards. There's nothing in the law or ethics to require somebody to have to show extraordinary circumstances. What we're looking at are, what are people's needs for reasonable accommodations that meet health and safety? And a third flaw in the August 13th policy is that it fails to adopt consistent standards and processes for decision-making about accommodations. And most of us have seen the way that this leads to a lack of even-handed decision-making based on the reality that there are unknown standards and unknown decision-making processes that the deans are using. So let's go to slide three for the resolved clauses. So these resolved clauses address the flaws of these two policies. And again, they call for logical and fair actions based on three principles, the three principles of safety, transparency, and consultation. The first one calls for the university to rescind the August 11th policy. The second resolved clause says that the university should adopt and announce policies that provide a broad and flexible approach for accommodations for all who need it. The next resolve clause says that the university should adopt and announce fair and consistent standards and processes for evaluating and making decisions about reasonable accommodations that faculty, instructors, staff, and students need for a safe and healthy teaching and learning environment. So that's fairness and transparency in both of these. And then finally, the last resolve clause says that to create these policies, the university administration should engage in good faith, full and open consultation with the faculty senate and other governance bodies to develop these good, reasonable accommodation policies. And that will bring in all our expertise.
Wind this up in a minute or so, okay?
I am actually just about to wind it up. This participation through faculty governance and governance with other bodies will bring in experts in science, health, law, policymaking. You know, there are many areas where our participation and the participation by other governance bodies will make these good, open, and fair policies that meet our needs. And I would just note that this is certainly, it's a good time to do it. We should have done it earlier. It's a particularly good time to do it now, given that the governor of New York has announced that all employers, including private employers, must adopt plans to address COVID under the New York HERO Act. And so this is a requirement, and this is the moment we should do this. And so now I'll stop, and you'll hear from Richard Bensel about the second resolution dealing with faculty discretion to teach remotely on a temporary basis. Thank you.
I think we're gonna go to a short discussion of resolution one before hearing from Richard Benson, then another 10-minute discussion, and then a more general discussion.
Great, thank you.
So I think we open it up for discussion on resolution one, and there is a raised hands function in the reactions tab on your bottom menu bar. And you should raise your hand, and I should see that I'm seeing Courtney Roby. So you can unmute yourself, and please unraise your hand as soon as you start talking, and you have 2 minutes.
Thanks very much. I just want to say that I think this is an important resolution. I was glad to be one of the endorsers. I also, you know, think that we have to tread very carefully when it comes to what constitutes reasonable accommodations for both faculty and students, because, you know, I think we all experienced the labor issues last year that surrounded accommodations for students who needed to teach remotely. There is anecdotally a lot of interest among students in receiving accommodations to take classes remotely. So I think this just has to be, you know, part of our discussion at some point is, you know, how does Cornell meet its ethical obligations to faculty without creating additional ramifying problems of that the kind of labor issues of high flex teaching that we were encouraged to think about last year. I yield the rest of my time.
I don't see any hands up. Yes, I do now. So I'm going to recognize Becca Harrison. I'm not exactly sure, as speaker, the propriety of graduate students speaking, but since there are no other hands raised, I think we will have Becca speak for 2 minutes.
Thank you so much for your time. So as was said, I'm a graduate student. I'm a PhD candidate in science and technology studies, and I served as the graduate student representative on the Provost's Teaching Reactivation COVID Planning Committee last year, and have since remained an outspoken, I've spoken out quite a bit about Cornell's reopening, and have more recently found myself in the middle of these conversations about medical and disability related teaching accommodations. I wanna be clear, I don't know how closely people followed it last year, but this is something that graduate students pushed for in writing 16 or 17 months ago. So this is not a new thing to us either. A few other graduate student instructors and I have been in touch with RESA and several other faculty leaders to echo our appreciation and support for both of these resolutions, I guess, as well as our thanks for continuing to include graduate student instructor interests in your consideration of these policies. Given the power dynamics at play in many grad teaching assignments and our relationships with our individual departments, I don't see enough interest in substantial public collective organizing among graduate students in the same way that faculty have been able to. But I want to be clear and reiterate that these questions about many of the assumptions built into claims about classroom safety, about the lack of contact tracing in classrooms, about the risks to our own families and children, all apply to us just the same as they do faculty. So you might not hear about it, but graduate students are pretty concerned. The system in place to receive accommodations as graduate students is unclear, inaccessible, and discriminatory. Another graduate student asked for clarification on this process last week when the provost attended our GPSA meeting, and it became quite evident that there was not one. So not only is it unclear, but until last week, it didn't even exist. I followed up for more information about the policy and was actually able to receive my own medical accommodation and permission to move my entire first year writing seminar online. And I'm obviously grateful for this, but I know far too many worried graduate students and faculty who have not had this choice. Access to accommodation should not require the institutional knowledge that someone like me has after over a decade as both an undergraduate and now graduate student here at Cornell. Which seems to have helped immensely in helping me skip some of the steps by communicating with administrators who I know directly. I still don't actually understand the text of this policy, which I found a way through. And the general policy for seeking accommodations is still really unclear. Graduate students have not had an opportunity to provide input on it, and we're really depending on this faculty organizing that's happening right here to help us to have our voices heard. So I just wanted to echo all of this and say thank you.
General discussion after Richard Benson speaks. So why don't we move to resolution two? And Richard Benson, unmute yourself, and you have 5 minutes.
Thank you very much. I'm going to approach this in a slightly different way because I've heard so many comments, descriptions of how the pandemic and university regulations have affected teaching. I want to begin with what Risa said. I went to teach in person last year in both semesters. I taught my classes in person. I know that's true of many of you and in fact, most faculty. This resolution on discretion is not about escaping the classroom. There are two personal experiences. They're unique for me, but I think they illustrate the problems and the difficulties that we confront. They're general in other ways. At one point this semester, for my own seminar, I had three students who were positive. I subsequently received a message from the Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education asking if I had any questions about how to deal with the situation. I responded that I would turn the seminar into an online course if any more students turned up positive. The central administration response was that I should consult with my department chair, quote, to see if there might be creative responses to remain connected with students. My response to that was that seminars require class discussion. And that meant, as an elementary fact, that students had to be in the same place at the same time. And if they were sick, I would go online to have that happen. The whole experience raised for me doubts as to whether the Vice Provost's office really knows much about teaching. Seminars are class discussion. You have to be there. The second personal experience has to do with classrooms. My seminar was originally assigned Sibley 142. Probably don't know what that room looks like or what it is. I went to look at the room in August. It was, in fact, a storage room. It was long, it was narrow, it was small. It had two windows that opened up on a covered walkway. It was cramped, no ventilation that I could see. Most importantly, it was crammed with equipment, much of it at chin level. It was up to here. I was told that this would be removed before the class started, but it was, in short, a terrible room. I subsequently found a room in Olin Library and abandoned this storage room. From this and the other experiences that I've heard from faculty, there seems to be a shortage of classroom space at Cornell. A lot of people are crammed into spaces that even without the pandemic would be problematic. Going online in those cases, which are really egregiously poorly suited, both for seminars in general, but also for the pandemic, would resolve some of the most serious problems caused by that shortage. But the most important things about this resolution are there are serious problems with teaching at Cornell. The central administration is clearly not equipped to solve them. When they offer general regulations, they don't fit individual unique cases, and that's what we all are and confront. The faculty are the only ones who can gauge the impact on their teaching. To teach, to keep their students safe, to teach them the things that we have to teach them. This is resolution is about our responsibilities as faculty, our autonomy to achieve to those responsibilities. Let me come back to the screens. So the resolution, can we go to the second screen? This is the statement that Risa referred to from the national AAUP president. I think it is a very clear and statement of what our policy should be and what our interests are. Now, if we could scroll down, because I've sent these out to all of you and you've seen them, the whereases, some of the information that we got from the president. The provost and the president have reported information verbally about frequency of student to student and student to faculty instructor.
You should wrap up next minute, Richard.
Yes. Okay. No, I can. But there's been no detailed information. We don't know how many faculty are sick. When we're told that there are clusters, there's no network analysis of the transmission. There is nothing that we're told that all this information is being collected and is being used to make general policy, but we don't know what it is. And it would be nice to have it because faculty have to make individual decisions about the safety of their students and themselves. And in order to do that, we need more information about the transmission and who's been infected and how. I address that because that's been one of the more controversial parts of the whereases. It is a whereas. In a sense, it's a request for more information. By the way, if you want me to respond, I realize the chat has been disabled, even the private chat, so you can't even ask private questions of individual senators. If you want me to respond to any of the resolution or anything I've said, please address me and then I'll do that. I don't see any other way to do it. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have 10 minutes for a discussion of resolution 2. And within that discussion, it's appropriate if you want to ask questions, we could have a bit of a conversation. I'm waiting to see some hands up and I will be happy to call on you. Uh, TJ and Hinrichs, please unmute yourself. 2 minutes, please.
Thank you so much. I think there was a student op-ed in which she described getting a positive test and getting that result after she had attended classes. And so it sounds as though because of the gap between the test and the results that some students are attending classes after positive results. I know a number of students who are graduate students who have described multiple students in their classes coming up positive. Last week, I had a graduate student FWS instructor who reported 4 in her class of 17. And I'll talk with them again tomorrow, but it wasn't, you know, she was not getting contact traced. So they're saying that there's no classroom transmission, but I see no evidence of classroom contact tracing. And so that's a big concern, at least for the graduate students that I'm talking with.
Thank you. Harry Katz, unmute yourself, 2 minutes.
Thank you. I'll speak to the second resolution. There's many things about it that I strongly support and favor. The request for more information, the request for more engagement with individual faculty and with the Faculty Senate and with others who have expertise to add. The part of the resolution that I disagree with is that it says that faculty member at their sole discretion can decide to shift online. I would favor a request that faculty in consultation with their respective dean should engage in discussions regarding how and whether they should shift online. I've been a dean and I have confidence not only in the current dean at ILR, but in other deans of the colleges at Cornell, that they would come to reasonable judgments in discussion with their faculty and reasonable accommodation. I'm sympathetic to those that were put off by the tone of the August 11th communication, which suggested there was an absolute rule against accommodations other than not teaching for a semester. I would favor a process in which the faculty, in consultation and discussion with the dean, are encouraged to engage in discourse that could allow and lead to online teaching. And I think that would be a much better approach. Thanks.
Thank you. Catherine, you're on for 2 minutes.
Apologies, I can't figure out how to rename myself. This is Catherine Appert. I would just respond quickly. Thank you for making that point. I have to disagree, and I think the reason I have to disagree is that, well, I don't think, the reason I have to disagree is that it's imperative that we always remain conscious of the ways in which race and gender and sexuality and ability and rank impact our ability to have faith in a dean or in a chair to act in our best interest or to collaborate with us in any sense. And so, although I think in an ideal world that yes, that would be the approach we might want to take, I think many, many faculty at Cornell could speak from personal experience that they're not confident in having their needs met in this instance and in other instances, if it's to do so relying on the goodwill of administrators. And so, and again, that those are things that play out in various ways, in ways that are race, that are gendered, et cetera. And so I would just add that to the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Courtney Roby, 2 minutes.
Thank you. First of all, Richard, as somebody else who was also assigned a storage room as a classroom, mine was full of Christmas decorations, which was kind of fun, but I'm glad to have been assigned to a real classroom. We cannot overstate the difference in the, level of quality of facilities across campus and between colleges. I think, many of my colleagues in the humanities, we, have found ourselves assigned to teach in classrooms with no ventilation, no air movement at all. And whereas many of my colleagues in the sciences are teaching in newer facilities with plenty of air circulation. So I think the actual situation on the ground looks very different across campus. I agree with Terry that the path to reconciling some of these differences ought to be through our deans, but the dean of my college has not yet had a meeting with the chairs and attempts, at least by my chair, to get in contact with his office to reconcile some of the very real issues that faculty are having with their classrooms have not been replied to. So yes, there are huge differences, I think, in the experiences that faculty in different colleges, different disciplines, different parts of campus are having. So that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Thank you. And Wendy Wilcox, 2 minutes.
Thank you. I guess I'm a little perplexed because with the first resolution that Risa presented, my understanding was that we wanted to rescind the August 11th declaration that there will be no remote teaching and create a procedure policy that is fair and equitable for faculty, staff, graduate students, that would allow them to seek accommodations which may or may not include remote teaching, which I think is a very fair approach to this. The reason I'm confused is that I thought that the medical accommodations office was actually that process. So if anyone after I speak can clarify that, that would be helpful. The second thing I need to speak up on behalf of is that we need to be cognizant of our staff colleagues who have been somewhat maintaining a physical presence on this campus in ways that faculty were given choices and they were not. We have colleagues keeping the libraries open so that we can browse the stacks, so that students have places to study, so students have places to take their Zoom classes. And that also creates a really additional burden so on the campus. So I cannot be in favor of any resolution that gives faculty choices that privilege them over our colleagues who don't have those choices. And as I understand it, the Medical Accommodations Act or Medical Accommodations Office is the procedure that any staff would need to pursue in order to get an accommodation. So I just feel like, I should also say that mass compliance and safety is going to be the best in the classrooms as opposed to other environments on campus, such as dining halls, which are very overcrowded. Libraries, study spaces, which are not de-densified. So part of me just really stands by the sciences telling us that these other environments are okay. So why should classrooms be treated differently?
Thank you. We've come to the end of our 10-minute discussion period, but actually we now emerge into our 35-minute general discussion period. So perhaps I'm looking for hands up, and I see Richard. If there's others, get in the queue, and we can maybe resolve some of these outstanding questions. So Richard, you're on. Also 2 minutes.
No, I appreciate Wendy's comments. One of the big differences, of course, is in a seminar room, you have 15 kids and they're, you know, cheek to jowl around you. That is not one of the situations that staff members often find themselves in. It's qualitatively just very, very different. The other problem is staff members don't have to have a collective discussion, for example. So when staff members get diagnosed as positive, they drop out, but it isn't a discussion that's a continuing one for the classroom. These are just very different. Education is just a very different task. And it's, I want to emphasize that this is, yes, there are probably some faculty who would say, yes, boy, if I have sole discretion, I will teach online and boy, I'll go to New York City or wherever and live the high life. There may be some people like that, but faculty discretion over teaching, people I know, and the vast majority of the people in this session are dedicated teachers. They want to do the best job they can, and they can't if the university is run like an army camp with rules that don't fit the educational environment, needs of the faculty member. We all teach in very different ways. That's the reason why in most universities, the education department, we don't have one, but if it did, it's usually the weakest or one of the weakest in the social sciences. There's just no way to make it one size fits all. We have to do it the way we teach. This is an emergency thing. I'm not saying we should go online, you know, and when the pandemic is over. You know, this is an emergency thing for maintaining the quality and the safety of our students and the quality of instruction that we offer. That's it.
Thanks. I see SC Pryor, unmute yourself.
Hi, I just wanted to really thank Richard and Risa for having courage, because it has taken some courage to come forward here. So really appreciate your thoughtfulness and your courage. I wanted to just comment on two matters. One is that I think at the most fundamental core here, this is about saying that the faculty should have rights. At the very core of this, I think we should have rights. And I'm concerned that it concerns me that we do have administrators who seem so unwilling to presume that the faculty will exercise those rights reasonably. I don't agree there are some faculty who would dash off to New York City if they could teach remotely, because I think we are a faculty of enormous integrity. I think the second thing I want to say is that we are the faculty senate. So whilst, of course, we should be cognizant of the needs of and supportive of the needs of others, our role is to our faculty colleagues. And therefore, I think it is appropriate that this resolution speak to represent ourselves and our faculty colleagues. Thank you for your time.
Laurent, you're on for 2 minutes.
Thank you. And I would like to say how much I support the previous comments I heard. I will, in a sense, reiterate a little bit. But first thing, as many people in the humanities, but many people in the human sciences and beyond, most of what I teach is in the seminar format. There is no doubt that teaching in person is better than teaching online. I'm not completely sure that teaching in person with masks on is so much better, but that slightly different topic in a sense. So we would like to be in the classroom, and I'm in the classroom every day. on these notes, we are not in a near normal situation. You saw that, the provost and the president have talking points. And so they speak about the near normal situation. That's not a near normal situation if masks are mandatory, for instance. And the problem is not so much about compassion. I know that Mike wrote in a message that his approach was compassionate, but I'm not interested in getting the compassion from the central administration. I don't care at all about their compassion, to be honest. I'm more interested in shared governance. And in fact, instead of lecturing us regularly with the repetition of the same ideas over and over again, instead of showing us a certain level of contempt, the central administration should accept the fact that we are in a position to make decisions on our own and about ourselves. And clearly, it's true that there seems to be this idea that we will all go to the Bahamas. I mean, it's better than New York City even. We will all go to the Bahamas and maybe go to Zoom once in a while to see if our students are still alive in another part of the world. But it's not very likely that this is our goal for our own life. And so the main reason I see behind a refusal to give us the autonomy to decide what is best for us is the anxiety about us as faculty abusing the right to choose. And I don't believe that this is the right approach at all. I believe especially that the Faculty Senate should not wait for a kind of layer of approval up to a dean or above the dean's level to go onto a Zoom if we believe as instructors that it's a better situation. In many cases, it won't be a better situation. So we are just reclaiming the right to have the possibility of making a decision that would be, of course, reasonable and of course would be tied to the very particular circumstances we are facing.
Thank you. Cora, I don't see your last name yet, but you know who you are. Unmute and
Yes, Roman Studies, yeah. I'd like to, someone or other mentioned the Office for Disabilities. I know people who have disabilities registered for a number of years, have had a number of decades, in fact, at Cornell. And when these people, these colleagues, approached Office for Disabilities, they were told that approving online teaching is not an accommodation that medical disabilities office is currently extending. That's their answer. Just so that we know.
Typically, we want to get new people to speak before repeaters, but if I don't see any raised hands, I'll turn it over to Becca Harrison again. 2 minutes.
And I just want to follow up on that previous point about the Student Disability Services Office. This is the experience graduate students are having too. And the updated text of the policy as it exists right now is to send us to SDS, similar to how faculty and staff are encouraged to reach out to the medical leaves office. And so this obviously creates an issue. If you go to the SDS website, it becomes very clear that their only resources for instructors are for instructors who are assisting their students who come to them with accommodation needs. So we're being sent to an office that isn't prepared for us, but also is overburdened because everyone is being sent there when they don't know what to do.
So I'm seeing three repeaters, so I'm gonna pass them by temporarily and go to Ruth Richardson for 2 minutes. And then if we have time, we'll go back to Risa, TJ, and Catherine. So Ruth first.
Great, thank you. I just wanted to, this may or may not be germane, but I am an instructor intent on staying in the classroom and my students want that. But I anticipate every class or two, one student is gonna need accommodation until the numbers go down. And that puts a pretty big burden on managing me and my TA. those students and getting them the content? Is it germane to talk about how the university is supporting that additional burden for those of us trying to be in person?
Thank you. I see some new people in the queue. Celia Vigonis, 2 minutes.
Yep, thank you. And I apologize, I'm in my car. So apologize for the unprofessional sitting in the video. I again want to reiterate a lot of what others have said. I'm not going to take anybody's time doing so. And I want to express gratitude to those who have spoken, in particular Teresa and Richard. My point is, as a lawyer, I always think about if we're asking for something, if we're asking somebody to do something, are we very clear about what we're asking for and can it be implemented? And in my mind, one of the reasons why these two resolutions are so reasonable is because we are not asking for anything impossible. In fact, we are asking in many ways for something that Cornell did really well last year. I was in the camp of people last year who was skeptical about how Cornell was going to manage the pandemic. And I wound up feeling as if I was well taken care of as a faculty member. My students had a good experience and I felt safe as a community member. We're asking Cornell not to go above and beyond and do the impossible. We're asking to do what they've proven they can do. So, you know, last year there was a combination of robust testing that we don't have right now. I get tested voluntarily once or twice a week. I'm usually waiting a day or two for an appointment. My most recent test, I waited 72 hours for the results. We had robust testing. We had a de-densified campus. We had some discretion over our methods of teaching. These are all simple things that we are asking for. Cornell has been relying on vaccines only and vaccines plus masks more recently, but are not showing flexibility in adapting to any of these were put forward. So I just want to say that I am generally in support of the resolutions. I also think that there are reasonable, measured steps that the university can take to meet the concerns that are being voiced in these resolutions and that would not impose undue harm or cost or expense or effort on anybody in the university. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll go to Catherine Caggiano, 2 minutes.
Thank you. I appreciate everyone's time here and the thoughtfulness that really everybody is putting forward in voicing their concerns. It just sort of strikes me back to a comments that were made earlier about really the administration in putting forth these different policies, sort of erring on the side, defaulting on the side of enforcement as opposed to faculty judgment. So I've heard essentially lots of calls here for essentially saying, look, as the administration, you know, they should trust us as a faculty. And I agree with that. At the same time, I also think it's reasonable to, you know, trust but verify. I don't think it's unreasonable for, if nothing else, tracking purposes for the university to want perhaps at least some sort of verification of when we choose to do so, right? If we say, trust us, it's fine. We all want to be in the classroom and we believe that that's true. Then I am not sure, and I realize this is opening a can of worms, some sort of mechanism just to demonstrate, you know, if and when people choose to do this provides a track record. It provides evidence that we can and do stand by our word and are only requesting or making these sorts of decisions when they're needed. That's my thought. Thank you.
Thank you. Risa, you're on for 2 minutes.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate all of the comments that are coming out here. I want to address the questions that were raised about the, I think Wendy raised it about the medical accommodations, whatever the medical leave office is called. Yeah, I guess medical leave office. And some of the other points that were raised in relation to that. One is to talk about the fact that we have problems with the content of, and now I'm talking about the resolution that I presented with regard to accommodations. So we have problems with the content of what will qualify to get an accommodation, as well as what kind of accommodation one will get. And we're also talking about the process by which the decisions, the evaluation decisions are made to assess a request for an accommodation. And we have problems in both areas. One is, to go back to the point about ethics, that an ethically driven needs-based policy would not simply rely on legal obligations with regard to defining a particular individual with a disability under the law. As I said, the current policies do not even meet the legal standards. But beyond that, what we're talking about are, what do people need? And so we need the content to reflect that ethically driven approach, so that we consider issues like people with at-risk family members, people with children who are not immunized, even if the individual asking for the accommodation does not have a disability, for example. We're also talking about issues of age, which actually will come under the new HERO Act to be considered, but are not considered under disability law. So we need a better content, which is why, of course, we need the governance process to make the content better and clear. But we also need a process that, through governance, makes clear and open what is now unclear, confusing, and opaque, so that we know how the process will work. I've heard many people talk about the confusing nature of when they even try to contact these offices. Becca Harrison talked about it today. I've heard story after story about delays, not getting responses, and the opacity, the confusing nature of this, and then the lack of even-handedness at the university level, as well as at the college and school level, with regard to the way this confusing, opaque process is being carried out. And that's where, again, the governance will open that up and make it one where we actually know what the content of the process is. And then, you know, just one other quick thing about following the science. The university has emphasized correctly the need for social distancing, but it seems to be only with regard to students outside of classes that they talk about that. If we're actually talking about the science and the need for social distancing, that's one of the reasons why people are having such concerns about teaching in overcrowded classrooms. So, you know, the resolution that Richard Bensel presented about faculty discretion also takes that into account. So thanks.
Thank you. Ashley Newman, 2 minutes.
Hi, so I'm new here, and I just have a couple thoughts. I'm new to the Faculty Senate, so you know, reading these resolutions, there are parts I agree with, and then there are sentiments which I'm kind of conflicting with. I do want to express, you know, it seems in the language, you know, and thank you for the clarification of ethical obligation, because it seems the language is, you know, Cornell is not providing us with this safe working environment. And I have colleagues in my profession and other institutions that are in states with, you know, far less rigorous, you know, no vaccine mandates, no mask mandates, no testing capabilities at all during this entire pandemic. And so I want to express some gratitude for what Cornell is doing. And I feel like that's maybe not in this conversation, because I do think we're quite fortunate to have I'm right down the hall in the vet school of where the testing lab is and where they're working their, you know, tails off to do this testing for everyone. So I do think that we have a safe work environment, but I'm empathetic to the student experience, and I feel like why the administration is doing this, and to try to have some unity in what student experience they can expect for this year. And I can imagine, if given individual choice, not that we're going to the Bahamas, but if you said, I feel more comfortable teaching remotely, than if everyone does, then all of a sudden you're a student that has all of your classes that are happening remote. And maybe you're a student that wanted to be in person. Now you've paid a lease, or, you know, your parents are paying your tuition, but then also living expenses, for example, in College Town. And, you know, and now there's no reason that you have to live in Ithaca. And dealing with the financial ramifications of that, I think, would be frustrating for students. And so I empathize with what the administration is kind of facing with, like, what are we telling parents and what are we telling students for what this year will be? I absolutely feel that faculty should have input in the process. And so I think that those resolutions for, you know, including faculty opinion in terms of, you know, the setting and that sort of thing should be a part of it. But I think that that's a perspective I have. And then the question of, you know, a reasonable accommodation for individual disabilities, I guess I'm confused on the language of, you know, if say I want to teach remotely, is it enough to say, because I feel more comfortable doing so, should that get me that accommodation? Or, you know, I am, for example, someone with two young children who are not old enough to be vaccinated. Do I have to have one of those tick items, or is it just based on individual faculty comfort level? I think that that's something that probably should be clarified. And I think that's maybe it. So I am supportive, you know, faculty being empowered, but I'm also a little bit of a team player and feeling like we need to have a unified approach. And so I guess I understand the policy and also support it from the student perspective, and that I do think their learning is better in person and the experience is better. And I think they're all Zoom fatigued, but I do think that we have to include the students and keep their learning going if they are in quarantine. And I know the Vet College has recording capabilities that students can watch recorded lectures or discussion sections after. So I think there needs to be that met for those students that are missing physical class if they're in quarantine.
Thank you. I'm gonna skip to Nima. Do you have a comment? Your hand is up.
It wasn't a comment about thank you, Jonathan. It wasn't a comment as much about the resolutions or the discussion, but just for our colleagues, the new senators who are joining us, you can bring amendments to the floor. It has to be seconded and then discussed, but it is possible. And I know that parliamentary procedures are things that we all learn as we go along, but that is a possibility. So I just want to raise that and remind everybody that that's a possibility.
Okay, looking at the hands up list of people who haven't spoken yet, I think Rodriguez is next. 2 minutes, please.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you both to Lisa and to Risa and Richard for the both resolutions, which I have also co-sponsored. And I wanted to put an emphasis, especially on the second one, and because I would like the administration to acknowledge how much work the faculty are doing again. I mean, many of my colleagues at Roman Studies and myself, we are teaching again on a hybrid mode. This is the only way we are keeping the students at home when they have symptoms. They are very anxious about missing class. And even though we've been told that we could just say, oh, we're back to normal, just ask your classmates for class notes and write me if you have questions. If you do so, you'll have them with fever, sore throat, and symptoms in the classroom in this period, this 72-hour period between the testing and the test and the test results. So we are de facto making those decisions. I'm constantly answering emails from students saying, oh, I have fever, I have a sore throat, I just got a negative test, but I feel that I'm getting worse. Should I come to class or not? So I think it would be great to have a little bit more of autonomy and support, and to be able to send our class maybe for a couple of weeks home if we feel that this is the only way to keep us all safe and healthy.
Thank you. Cora, Elizabeth, and your...
Yes, Cora, it's fine. So just to clarify, you know, it is obvious that teaching in person is preferable. And if anybody is thinking that Zoom teaching is great fun, and that it's fun to rely on a disability to do this, oh, well. You know, we have a lot to talk about here.
Thank you. We'll go back to TJ Hinrichs.
Hi, and just in support of Becca and the other graduate student TAs, I also wanted to point out that on the COVID faculty and staff in what is it called? Academic resources page. It tells faculty that if they are sick, they can have graduate student, they can have TAs fill in, or they can team teach with the TA. And I want to bring up something that one of my colleagues mentioned, which is that the university pushed very hard against TA unions on the basis that TAing has a pedagogical purpose and is therefore not labor. And so I just want to bring attention to that. If our TAs are substituting for lectures, it should be with the faculty present and for the purpose of feedback. It's not a fallback for a labor shortage.
Thank you. Richard, you're on again. 2 minutes, please.
Yeah, I was listened very sympathetically to Ashley's comments. I mean, you're a news editor and we do these things. We have resolutions and big discussions, and it's an unfamiliar territory. It's hard to get your balance and your footing in it. I'd say some things, again, a personal thing, which is, you know, my class was asked, they asked me after my three students were positive, they asked me to ask my students to take a supplemental test, the other 12 of them. And so I asked them. And then in the next class meeting, I said, well, did you take your test? And all of them had. And I was a little bit surprised because I see mass compliance on campus is not terribly good. But the these students wanted to be in the classroom. They were considering it a necessary condition. In-person teaching is what they want. No question about that, or at least in my classes, no question about it. More generally, their families want it. I know it from the central administration that when they, when the pandemic hit, they got a lot of comments from faculty, from families paying a lot of money to send their students to Cornell and said, what's going on? It's another wasted year. And the students sort of felt that too. That's an important consideration. The other one is they got to pay for the dorms. And unless it's in-person teaching, you know, the students are going to run off. And paying for the dorms is a fixed cost. What I'm saying about that is the central administration is not neutral. They have real reasons. Some of them we would be sympathetic with, and some of them we would say, well, that's about money. That's not about teaching. That's not about safety of the students and so forth. But they're not neutral. That's one of the reasons why faculty autonomy, making their own judgments based on the information that we have in hand, is so important. You know, the central administration does not, admittedly, they're in favor of in-person teaching for reasons that sort of constrain their judgment. And we need to release ourselves a little bit from that in order to do the right thing.
Thank you. Laurent, you're on again.
Yes, actually, I will follow directly what Richard was saying about the administration not being neutral. I mean, we should remember that the same people who were explaining to us and to the families and to the students last year that Zoom teaching was on a par with the in-person experience on a pedagogical level are the ones telling us today that it's a very different experience, which we knew since the very beginning. No doubt, most students, maybe all undergrads, would like to be in the classroom. And as I said, most professors would like to be in the classroom, and I'm in the classroom, and I'm happy to be there. It's true that I'm not known for showing a lot of empathy for the issues of the central administration, but in terms of team playing, the team is the team that we are building with the students in class. And so what really matters is this kind of collective dynamic that we will create in a classroom, outside, if we teach outside from time to time, and so on. And there, it's very clear that in the concrete way things are, when students are being removed from the classroom because they are in a quarantine, when you are encountering new bouts of anxiety and so on, it might be preferable to show some flexibility. And I believe that beyond the first resolution, which is telling the obvious about disability and about the law in this country. The second resolution is also putting the emphasis on the fact that we need to show in exceptional circumstances an exceptional level of flexibility, and that there, the people who know what is best is not only the faculty, but the faculty with the students. And so we are in this together. As for, I mean, to relate to a comment that was made before, as for professors declaring that they would move online for 1 week, and I don't see that the resolution would oppose that. I mean, it makes no reservation about that. And why not? I mean, you might want to have a little control, but that's not the same thing as controlling what is being done and having a kind of top-down process where the administration is with the same level of energy and effort promoting online teaching in year one and in-person experience teaching in year two.
I think we have time for maybe one more comment before going to the good of the order. And I only see Becca Harrison, so I think you have the last word, Becca.
Thank you, and please forgive the fact that I have a lot to say. But I think I want to say something on not necessarily representing students, but as a student, I want to encourage us to be really careful about the assumptions we make about what students want. I think that it's really easy for the administration to make this claim that students overwhelmingly want in-person classes, because when students chose to enroll and students chose to come to Ithaca, that was an implicit signal that this is what they want. And I think once they've started to realize what classes actually look like right now, it might still be a majority, but I think there's a lot of flexibility among undergrads about what they actually want to see. And to be honest, I think that last year they were kind of given a black and white choice of either everything you're gonna do is you're gonna stay home, live in your parents' basement and take stuff online and not have the college experience, but you're gonna pay for it. Whereas if you stayed on campus, you had a modified version of that. But I think that one thing I'm really concerned about, especially in the way that the university leadership is framing the options here, is that there's a lot of space between the option to not do anything and the option to magically hope things change. And to consider the fact that modifying a few classes at faculty discretion because instructors are worried about safety, leaves room for things like sports and Greek life and all of these things that actually drive students to want to be in person to still happen. So I think it needs to be contextualized and remembered that the student experience isn't just our classrooms, and that doesn't mean it's not valuable. But when they come here and make that commitment, they're committing to the whole package. And I think that they're willing, if we ask them today, anonymously without their parents' dollar attached to it, their answers might be very different. So I just want to throw that out there as some context. Thank you.
So we have a good of the order, which is sometimes called the good and welfare, which is a section of general comments, not related necessarily to the resolutions. And I think I'll first ask the Dean of Faculty, Eve, if she has anything to say in this section.
Actually, I just contributed to the chat first to say thank you, Jonathan, for playing a really critical role today. And thank you, Riza and Richard, for bringing these resolutions to the floor. And I'm really pleased that everyone who attended, especially those who contributed to the general discussion. So that's all I have to say.
So typically the good of the order are people that sort of sign up ahead of the meeting. In this case, we do have a few minutes. We don't have to use it. If there's any general comments that relate to your position here at Cornell or within the Faculty Senate, raise your hand. Cora, maybe you have something to say?
Yes, third time today. I was wondering if the new policy of keeping the chat closed will obtain from now on, or is it exceptional for today?
It's my intention to keep it. Yes.
Thank you.
A short comment from Harry Katz, and then if we have time, Tao Dufour.
My question relates to these resolutions. What's the next step? Is it that the resolutions will be circulated again to the whole faculty and a vote will be taken, or you know, what happens next with these resolutions?
Nima or Eve, would you like to speak to that?
So the Qualtrics will be released tonight and they'll be voted on as is, because they were not amended on in today's discussion. And you have 24 hours, so 5 p.m. tomorrow.
Okay. Tao?
Yeah, thank you, Jonathan. Thank you so much, Risa and Richard. I'm also a new member, and I just have a question about the protocol, which is similar to the previous.